The Source from the ATA, conversations about telehealth and virtual care from the thought leaders, experts, and visionaries who are working to change the way the world thinks about healthcare. I'm delighted today to have a conversation with Alexis McGill Johnson. She is the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Federation of America and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund. She has recently been appointed to the role after serving as acting president and CEO for the last year, and has held various leadership roles in both organizations for more than a decade. Alexis brings a researcher's lens to the justice issues of our time. She is a renowned social and racial justice leader, lifelong political and cultural organizer, and a tireless advocate for reproductive rights and access to quality, affordable healthcare. We are proud to have Planned Parenthood as a longstanding member of the ATA, and applaud their efforts to leverage technology to expand access to reproductive health services throughout the country, something we'll talk more about today. Welcome to the podcast, Alexis.
Thank you so much for having me, Anne.
It's a pleasure. So let me start off by asking, you've been a part of Planned Parenthood for a decade, but just became permanent president and CEO recently. Can you share with us a bit about your prior background and what brought you to this work and this moment?
Yes, absolutely. As you mentioned, I actually consider myself a researcher by trade. You know, like that kind of intersection between research and advocacy has always been my sweet spot, because I feel like, you know, there are amazing ideas that live in the academy, and then there's like the real world of operationalizing them. And so I've always wanted to create that space between them to apply, particularly to issues of justice, because there's so much kind of really important data-driven work that has to undergird how we think about shifting and changing culture and fighting back on some of these challenging times. So I joined the board of Planned Parenthood actually almost a decade ago when I saw a very racist billboard around access to abortion. And, you know, it was one of those moments where I just felt like I needed to jump in, right? I think sometimes they say leadership, you know, as you know, like leadership we find in everyday experiences, but sometimes you just see a fight and you just want to jump in on it. And it was one of those moments that I feel like at this moment in particular, this kind of reckoning that we're experiencing across the country in so many different ways, from healthcare disparity to racial injustice to, all of the things that are happening around us, just bringing, you know, all of my various disciplines to bear at this organization at this time just felt like the right step for me.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I think it's really phenomenal. And we will touch on some of these in a little bit, but I wanted to make sure that I understood and our audience understood how your background, for example, in bias research and so forth, really informed what you're doing now and what that's going to bring to Planned Parenthood in terms of your orientation and work.
Yeah, absolutely. So almost in the same decade ago, I co-founded an institute called the Perception Institute, which is really a group of researchers and strategists who were using brain science around how our brains and bodies process identity differences, and turning those identity differences into actual solutions that that help us understand our interactions. And so, you know, the idea of implicit bias, again, was one of those things that was largely living in the academy, and really pioneering research was happening documenting the phenomena, which is different than kind of explicit, old school racism. And yet, you know, we knew that it had implications for healthcare. We knew it had implications for education, for policing, but we weren't necessarily translating that work into real interventions in those various spheres. And so the work that I did was to cohere this group of researchers and strategists and to really design interventions and trainings and really data-driven systemic approaches to transforming institutions in ways that would mitigate bias and mitigate racial anxiety and gender anxiety. And that's the background that I think, you know, again, in this moment, you know, we've been able to work with our, you know, many providers across our federation. And when you improve the patient-provider relationship, when you mitigate against bias and racial anxiety, not only does it create greater patient satisfaction, it also creates greater compliance. And so thinking about the kind of outcomes that we need to see and walking them backwards from the, you know, the kind of unconscious things that are happening in our brain is part of the work that I think, you know, we as an organization at Planned Parenthood need to be thinking about as we, you know, dig deeper into this moment.
I love that. I think that there will be a lot that we can be doing together in terms of this notion of improving the patient-provider interaction and addressing things like bias in the process. But let me ask you about earlier this spring, you announced an expansion effort to provide sexual healthcare access to all 50 states in response to COVID-19. Can you talk more about this effort and other ways that you've responded to the pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I'm sure for you and many of the folks listening, like COVID has not just been this profound disruption, right? I mean, it has stopped us from the way we interact with each other, the way we school, the way we work, the way we engage in meetings, you know, and social hours. But it's also been for us, oddly, an accelerator. You know, we began investing in telehealth more than 5 years ago, and the technology and the, you know, thinking about how this form of care would be able to expand access, particularly to rural underserved populations, really evolved rapidly over the last couple of years. But this pandemic moment, you know, really kind of helped accelerate the infrastructure that we were building, right? And within, you know, I think the article was something like 10 years and 10 days, you know, we knew that in that moment, everywhere needed access to healthcare, because people weren't going to stop having sex during the pandemic. People still needed access to family planning. They still needed access to STI testing and so forth. And so our affiliates across the country were able to build that in, you know, and really help address some of the other kind of unprecedented hurdles that we were experiencing, like PPE supply shortages and so forth.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I think that the pandemic and all the other social, you know, racial issues that we're really addressing, it's a very uncommon time. So I really think it'll be interesting to see how we all come out of this on the other side. Can you talk to us for a second about what makes Planned Parenthood unique as an organization? And what are you most excited about or inspired by as you think about the future of the organization?
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, look, I think what makes us unique is that, you know, when patients come to Planned Parenthood, they are coming, you know, they're coming sometimes for the most intimate of care, right? They need a trusted messenger. They need a trusted provider who will, you know, really think how, you know, how to engage with issues around, you know, sex positivity, around affirming gender care, around access to, again, family planning and access to abortion, which, you know, the demand for that increased rapidly during the pandemic. And, you know, I really think that it's that our kind of holistic offering from education to our, which we also are now delivering, you know, online in a kind of, in a telehealth way, to our provision of service, I think has made us, you know, you know, just the fact that people come to us for very non-judgmental work, I think has been really, really important.
That's interesting. And it sounds like in the entire process, you've still been able to afford an environment where there's trust between patients and providers, even using technology.
Yeah. And I think that just has a lot to do with that is largely what we're known for, right? I think that there is, you know, and you've been in these conversations as well, when you talk to healthcare providers and they're thinking about kind of the rapid disruption that is happening because of innovation and technology, that, you know, that they may have opportunities to scale differently because of the kinds of resources that they may have backing them, and the fact that they are, you know, many in many cases for profit, and they can kind of refine tools. But as, you know, as a nonprofit and as an organization that is deeply grounded in its commitment to being part of the public health infrastructure, you know, creating a space that is filled with dignity, that's filled with respect, that is filled with trust around our, you know, our body's most intimate changes, I think is really critical. And I think that's just the baseline that we hold at, you know, at our Planned Parenthood health centers, because, you know, it's so critical that people feel the, you know, the freedom. I mean, that's what mm-hmm. that's what we're dealing, Planned Parenthood, I like to say. It's like, yeah. We're dealing freedom, and you have to trust people that they're going to take you through that.
Got it. That's great. So, Alexis, there are several challenges that the larger telehealth community is facing as we move forward, thinking about areas such as policy, access, and equity, for example. What challenges do you see Planned Parenthood facing as you move forward?
So it's interesting because I feel like, you know, this is all brand new, right? We've been building so much of the infrastructure to really, you know, provide the service. And, you know, we are obviously, you know, very familiar with the policy process. We advocate with policymakers on, you know, on issues from sex education to abortion, you know, in states, all, you know, literally in every state across the country. But with telehealth, I think this moment of COVID is really about how do we begin to cement some of the gains that we've made around telehealth, and how do we think about what do we need to, you know, kind of push forward. I think that, you know, our affiliates on the state level are working to solidify things like, you know, ensuring payment parity for all modalities. You know, like, you know, we know that because most healthcare is grounded in the practice of folks coming in to into a bricks and mortar health center, and this is a different kind of way in which we show up, that payment parity does not necessarily exist in every state across the board. So I think that's probably one of the biggest questions around sustainability. I think how we, particularly as we see access to limits on restriction to abortion or access to family planning with the Title X rulings, you know, creating opportunities for our providers to have more flexibility to offer telehealth services, you know, as states start to waive their definitions of the originating site, I think that becomes a huge piece. And then I also think these kind of establishing that provider-patient relationship. You know, there are lots of states with statutes or regulations that require a pre-existing relationship with a patient, or or needing to see a patient multiple times. You know, the same provider seeing the same patient multiple times before access to a procedure. And I think those kinds of limitations are things that, particularly during COVID-19, you know, have just made plain that they're unnecessary, in fact, barriers to access. You know, last I'd say that, you know, I spent a whole bunch of time, you know, advocating, talking to our lawmakers in Congress, particularly Senator Schumer, as he was focusing on the CARES Act and putting these things forward around, you know, it's one thing to kind of, you know, shift the ways in which our, you know, healthcare is provided, and loosening up those regs, it becomes really important. But we also have to make sure that we are maintaining, you know, our ability to sustain that provision of care. And so being able to get that payment parity, being able to ensure that our providers can see patients across state lines as folks are moving or they're stuck because of the sheltering in place laws. You know, those are the kinds of things that I think become really important, and to be backed up with real stories, patient stories, so they understand that this is not like academic. This is actually what's really happening on the ground.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the data is important, but the stories almost capture the hearts and minds more mm-hmm. of the legislators and regulators. So if I could, from your perspective, given your background and your standing at the crossroads of research and advocacy and the work that you've done on implicit bias, and we're really faced with how the pandemic exposed in a very raw fashion what we've all known has been inconsistent access to care, and the toll that it's taken on minority populations, you know, Black people of color, has been significant, and wondering if you have perspectives on that as you think about the broader healthcare system and for others who are listening into your podcast from our audience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that I think you're right. I mean, COVID has laid bare the disparity in, you know, public health infrastructure, right? It's the disparity in housing, in you know, education, who's able to sustain, you know, 8 hours of Zoom school and who's not. And I think healthcare is one of those places where particularly because so much of the population that is people of color were deemed essential workers. You know, like I live in New York City, and you know, we're all sheltering in place, and the people who I still see getting on the, you know, on the A train, you know, they all look like me. They're people of color and largely women, because mm-hmm. they were, you know, ironically deemed essential workers. And yet, you know, their lives, their access to basic PPE, their access to, in some states, controlling their own bodies, you know, was denied. And so I think that it's really important for us to kind of consider how race as an overlay on health generally operates, and that it is not just, you know, it's not just a case of doctors having explicit bias. In many ways, it's that we've carried biases, assumptions about treatment, about compliance, about, you know, tolerance of pain, that that have not only kind of impacted the kind of care that that doctors provide, but also it's impacted the way patients show up in the, you know, in the exam room, because they don't want to reinforce those biases. And there's a very layered way in which kind of bias, anxiety around having conversations around race in particular, as well as the kind of what we call stereotype, patient stereotype threat, you know, that kind of limits access, you know, limits the kind of information that a patient would give to a doctor to not reinforce, that becomes this really horrible cycle that really impacts the kind of care that one receives. And so I just think that the bias conversation in particular, in this moment, I think cannot be discussed enough, because, you know, the impact on this population of society has been so critical, and the barriers, the structural barriers that exist, were already so great that that's part of the reason why we're seeing such dramatic shifts around not just incidence of COVID, but mortality due to COVID. And I think that's a critical thing.
I really appreciate that. And you're really giving us all a lot to think about, because what you're suggesting is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that even if we had all the connectivity and bandwidth in the world, and even if we had all the technology, if our fundamental way of interacting is lacking, or our ability to connect is lacking, then we still have sold the whole thing short, and there's a lot that we have to do. It's not just using technology to reimagine care. It's reimagining the care process. Yes. Does that make sense?
It does. And let me spell it out with like what it would actually look like in an exam room. Right. So like, you know, I show up, I've got, you know, I've got an STI, I've got a challenge. I'm worried about it. Right. Cause I have an STI and I don't know how to account for it. I go to see my doctor, and, you know, my doctor, may have implicit bias. We all hold biases. So, you know, may have a racial bias, and they may be associating, you know, kind of, a perception of me as a woman of color with, you know, I don't know, with a stereotype related to sexuality or promiscuity or something. And so I may not want to tell my doctor, right? And they may not know how to even ask me that question. So the kind of racial anxiety that they're experiencing with me is putting me on guard. May not be looking at the eye. I may be a little bit embarrassed about, you know, the care that I'm, you know, about to receive. And so when they start to ask me the questions, right, about how many partners I've had, how many, you know, my last sexual interaction, you know, these are questions that are already stigmatized for many people. And when you add that layer of how race is operating unconsciously in our brains, it means that I might not be as forthright to my my provider, and then that provider won't have the right information to make the diagnosis. And we know that doctors in particular who have high levels of bias and anxiety will cut short their appointments. They will ask, they won't ask as many questions. They are more likely to engage in kind of invasive procedures than ones where they feel like the patient won't be compliant. And so that interaction, the quality of the interaction, whether it is in an exam room or via telehealth, really matters, because it's a provider, you know, letting the patient know that they are seen, that they are valued, that they are understood, and that they are not judged. And I think at Planned Parenthood, that's one of the things that we work on consistently in our, you know, in our affiliates and our health centers, ensuring that our providers understand the potential dynamics that could be operating with a population that may look different from them in a way, and also have less access to resources to advocate for themselves. And so that just becomes really important, that quality of interaction, whether it's through telehealth, I think probably even more through telehealth, because you're not able to read the cues as well. You know, you're not able to see the body language in ways, I think it becomes even more critical.
I really appreciate you unpacking it that way. So thank you so much for that. So let's wrap up with a question about the future. Not that any of us have our crystal balls at hand or if they're still functioning, but thinking about your daughters and on a larger scale, this next generation coming of age, I'm curious what you see as being different in their world in the future as they grow up and versus the world that you grew up in.
Oh my goodness. So first of all, I have two girls, they're 8 and 11, and they are like, you know, light years beyond where I was at 8 and 11. They are, you know, this generation, this next generation that is coming up, they are they understand their identity so much differently, right? They understand gender, they understand race, sexual orientation, they understand the interaction of those, the kind of intersectionality that we often talk about. And they are just unapologetic about who they are, right? They are just, they understand that their very identity can't be separated out. And I think I think about that a lot, because, you know, these are the patients that we center oftentimes at Planned Parenthood. And, you know, I don't know, I'm really hopeful in watching this particular moment, whether it's the protests that we're seeing across the country, from racial discrimination to abortion rights to pride to immigration. There is just this way in which intersectionality is being operationalized. And, you know, I feel like I grew up in a generation, even though I'm, you know, I was born in 72, I like to say I'm as old as Roe. And in a way, even though my generation was the first generation to benefit from the, you know, the feminist movement and the civil rights movement, you know, there was a way in which I was being asked to model that freedom by diminishing myself, right? By code switching, by, you know, wearing shoulder pads in the 80s with my, you know, as my power suit, you know, or straightening my hair to fit in with other white women in a corporate setting. And so I don't see that in the same way in this generation. And that to me just gives me so much hope, because they just have a sense of themselves. They have a sense of freedom. They, you know, we don't have to imagine it for them. We just need to like build the infrastructure to help them get there. And I just think that's really powerful.
I love that. I think that's terrific. Alexis, I am so happy to have spoken with you. And thank you so much for all your leadership and fantastic work. And I look forward to touching base with you again soon.
Thanks so much for having me, Anne, and I look forward to connecting again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Source from the ATA. We want to hear from you. What topics should we cover? Who would you like to hear from? To share your comments and suggestions, and for more information about the ATA, telehealth, and virtual care, please visit our website, americantelemed.org, and our American Telemed accounts on LinkedIn and Twitter. Finally, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and share this podcast on your favorite platforms. It really makes a difference. Copyright 2020 ATA. All rights reserved.